Life expectancy content is for informational and storytelling purposes only. We are not medical professionals, and nothing discussed in this episode or contained on the life expectancy website should be taken as medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you're facing medical concerns, addiction, or any health-related challenges, please seek guidance from a qualified medical professional or a licensed healthcare provider. Thank you for being a part of our journey, and we encourage you to seek support from trusted professionals when needed.
Welcome to another episode of Life Expectancy, Sisters Surviving and Thriving. I'm Stacy.
And I'm Julie.
And thanks for joining us today. Today we're going to talk about the list. This list that I'm referring to is the UNOS list, which is vital in qualifying to receive organ donation. So let's do some academics here a little bit. So why don't you tell me, what does UNOS stand for?
Well, and today's episode is brought to you by
acronyms.
UNOS is the United Network for Organ Sharing.
Okay.
So UNOS is the overall list. It's a nonprofit charitable organization that helps with something called Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network, or the OPTN.
So that's for all organs, not just liver.
That's right. And we're going to get into some specific liver things. So the UNOS list is the actual list that's run by this nonprofit, but it's contracted and federally regulated by something called the OPTN, which is the Organ Procurement and Transplant Network.
So the UNOS list, they're not separate lists, right, for each hospital?
Right. So it's a national list, but within each hospital, there is going to be an individual ranking system. So in order for you to receive an organ, you have to be accepted into an organ transplant program at a specific hospital. And each hospital has the generalized criteria which are required, but they can also have additional criteria that might be a little bit variable between this hospital and the next hospital.
And just to be clear, not every hospital does organ transplants.
No. In fact, it's incredibly expensive. You will most likely find them at Research One institutions. And there are small numbers of them in each state. So there can be none up to three or four. But those hospitals are ones that are doing the high-end research, the cutting-edge stuff. Mm-hmm. They're getting the most federal funding, usually. Mm-hmm. It's expensive to do an organ transplant.
And hospitals, let's not forget, they are a business as well.
They are. But they also are a business that's in the business of making sure that people are thriving and they're healthy. But things cost money. We can't get around that.
So I'm in Ohio. In Ohio, there are two, University of Cincinnati and Ohio State University. Mm-hmm. So shout outs to both.
Two Research One institutions. There are many other hospitals.
Oh, yeah. Today, we're just talking about organ transplant, the list, UNOS. So we got more acronyms coming your way. When you get onto the list, you are held to a score, which is called a MELD score. What does that stand for?
Well, there's two scores. There's an MELD and a PELD.
Okay.
The PELD is for individuals under the age of 12. And the MELD is for people over the age of 12. And it's a numeric scale that estimates the model for end-stage liver disease. So it is one, perhaps maybe the most comprehensive number, but there are other things they take into account, which we're going to talk about.
I was a 38.
At the time of her surgery, she was a 38 and climbing.
So from 6 to 40, there are points where you get too sick and you will be kicked off the list, and that is above 40. Now, I know that does change. It can vary in different cases, but from what I understood, and maybe this is just specific to my case, but from what I understood, when you get to that point, those higher numbers, it's your probability of surviving the surgery?
It's tipping the scale, right? So for example, if you have somebody at 38, somebody at 42, they're going to give the liver to the 38. Because once you get past 40, which is gravely ill, your chances of your body rebounding, even with the new liver, are starting to decline.
Okay.
So it's sort of like we're looking at the probabilities, right? So that's all they have to measure is the probabilities. So we're looking at where's the top end where it starts to become dangerous to even consider doing the surgery. If you aren't going to survive the surgery, now they're going to waste this really precious resource.
Yeah.
And they want people to get the resource that are going to have a good quality of life afterwards. And this is something they should look at. And I know it's hard to talk about, but the criteria that they're using, the math that they're using, is as fair as it can possibly be. And Stacey and I are going to dive in a little bit today. And I know that a lot of what I'm going to say is sort of going to feel like academic today.
No, but I think it's good because I went through this process and everything, but I will say I did not retain much of the cognitive knowledge that we're learning here. And so it's good to hear this again for me. And, you know, it helps when I'm talking about stuff like this too. So I'm learning and I welcome it. So our listeners will as well.
Well, good. So I want to say a couple things. First of all, it is specifically looking at the next 3 months, by the way. So your MELD score from 6 to 40 is talking about your probability of survival if you got a new organ in the next 3 months.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So, and then that's another reason why some of those
projection.
It is. Okay. And some of those diagnostic tests that you do to get on the list have to be repeated if you haven't received your organ in a certain period of time.
We'll get to those.
Yeah, because they have to see where are you right now, right? So just saying. And since Stacey's going to talk a little bit later about the length and waiting and how we wait and all of that, I think it's important to recognize. The other thing I want to mention is the MELD score is a complicated mathematical formula. We're not going to get into all of it, but I do want to talk about this. It is taking into account both your kidney and your liver function.
Okay.
And the reason for this is because your liver is an organ.
But they're BFFs.
They are BFFs.
They are BFFs.
That's a great way of thinking about it. So the liver is an organ that defies classification. In other words, it works in multiple systems. So a good example of this would be your heart is its own system, right? So you've got this organ, this muscle that pumps blood, and there's very little things we can measure with that to tell if your heart is healthy. For example, is the blood flow pushing against the vessels when it leaves your heart? And also how often your heart is pumping and if it's pumping in a good rhythm. And then also whether or not the blood is coming back to your heart at a rate that makes sense. So we have these measures that we can measure to determine heart function. But with the liver, because it's a detoxifying organ, it actually works to detoxify the body in multiple systems. So if your kidneys are not doing well and you get a new liver, that's not good. And oftentimes people do receive what they call piggyback. They receive
transplant.
A liver and kidney at the same time because that's how important the two of them are. Those are the two detoxifying organs in your body and they work together. Before getting so far deep into it, I just want to point out that it's special. It's a special organ and it's messy and it does a really big job. And so we can't just look at the liver function without also looking at the kidney function. And when we get to talking about the diagnostic tests that put you in good standing on the UNOS list, it's also because they want to make sure that the person who's receiving this organ, that the rest of their systems are strong enough to maintain this level of trauma. That's the MELD score and the PELD score. In addition to this, Stacey mentioned different hospitals. So this is where it gets really confusing for people. I'm going to try to simplify this down. Yes, the UNOS list is nationwide. However, the hospital that you're at is going to have a certain number of people that are also waiting for the same organ. And the average MELD score at that hospital is also going to impact where you are on the list. So for example, Stacey was at a 38 at the time she received her liver. We were really close to her being past the point of being easily considered.
Eligible.
I hate the word, but yeah.
I mean, that's the way that it is.
I know, but it's hard to stay. But anyway, yes. So at the University of Cincinnati, and this is hypothetical, I'm not giving the actual number because I don't know what it was, but if the average MELD score of every single person in the program waiting to get a liver was, say, 28, and Stacey's at a 38, that's going to put her at a certain spot. But if at Ohio State, for example, the average MELD score was a 32 and she was at a 38, that might have shifted things. Because even though we're doing the highest person of need, that highest person of need is going to be different if at this hospital there's 15 people at 35 and at this hospital there's 15 people at 6. So that's how the universal list can be affected by the individual hospital.
So in Ohio, there are two of them. I live in Cincinnati, Ohio, so the University of Cincinnati is 20 minutes from my house at the time. And Ohio State is about two and a half hours. When you are trying to qualify to get an organ, you meet with the hospital it's like a meet and greet almost. Like it's like a
orientation.
Yeah. You meet with their team of doctors, their coordinators. It's very intimate meetings. You're sitting in a room face to face with them. You're discussing your history and they're discussing some of their experience. It's definitely like a courtship in a way, or at least that's how I like to think about it. For us, it didn't seem initially very likely that I was going to get on a list through University of Cincinnati.
Well, really through anywhere, to be frank. She had been rejected already upon an admission there at least once. We had done an appeal. She was rejected a second time. We had gone through this now a couple of times. We were trying the third round at this particular hospital. At the same time, I had blasted literally every hospital that did liver organ transplant, because I would have flown her to California. We would have made it work no matter what. But one of the things to keep in mind is that it's not for everybody to leave your family and your friends and your life and do that. And I'm going to let Stacey talk about this a little bit, but it's complicated. This is a life-saving measure. But if we had even gone to Ohio State, for example, she would have been two and a half hours away from everything she knew, which meant not everybody would be around her as often. So for us, staying at home here in Cincinnati was a better choice, but we would have taken any choice we needed to.
Yeah, when your choice is needing this organ to live, and you make this choice that you want to continue life, the option pretty much is to do anything to make that happen. In my case, my situation was dire, kind of bleak. It didn't look very probable whatsoever. So I was weighing, do I want to go 2.5 hours to Ohio State and try to see if I could qualify with them? Did I want to go further if they could offer me an organ? Or if the probability that I wasn't going to possibly survive, did I want to be at home with my fiance? With my cats, by my mom, my dad, my sister? Did I want to spend that time in a plane or in a car? Organ failure, specifically liver, because that's my experience, is extremely painful. It's a very painful process to, well, kill your organ, because I did. I did it all myself. With a little bit of help from genetics, but I did most of it all myself. And so my advice to patients is more the mindset of my sister. Try for all of America. Try and put your name out there and your situation. And you want to live. And this organ, you need to live. So we went up to Ohio State and I met their team of doctors.
Yeah. And so it gets even a little bit more complicated because, yes, you should try for everything. But once you accept, or a hospital accepts you, or you accept them, or once you become part of their team, well, now you're kind of excluded from going to another hospital for insurance purposes, for other reasons. And you're on their list with respect to UNOS. So the UNOS list, although it's nationwide, is held by that hospital and their patients that are there. So if she would have accepted Ohio State, for example, and then we decided midway through that she wanted to come back to UC, that is a difficult process to do.
I think you reset the timeline.
You do. You reset the timeline to a certain extent. They can share your diagnostics and things.
I think it's up to the institution and the system you're working with.
There's ways around it, but it's one of these things. Just keep in mind that you might be prolonging the timeline, but also it's that mean score that I mentioned, right? So if you are at the Ohio State University and it's a smaller program, which this was, and they had less people, that could increase or decrease your chances depending on how sick the people are that are there. And you're not going to know that. They can't tell you because it's a HIPAA violation. They can tell you how many liver transplant patients they have, but they cannot tell you what their MELD scores are. So there's a lot of guessing involved here. And you just have to keep your focus on your person and figure out what is best for them. In this case, we got lucky. In fact, I remember going back to UC saying, hey, we went to Ohio State and we'd rather be here. I did make an argument. I was arguing a lot, which I'm not sure everybody does. But I treated it sort of like, well, let's have this conversation. You know, my sister was young.
She made a case for me like a lawyer.
I did make a case. I don't even know if that had any impact. But
you know, I will say this again, it's a little cold and calloused, but hospitals are a business. And what my sister did was present a case about me being a positive number, a number of success with an organ transplant that she knew my determination. And so far she's been right. I'm almost over 4 years sober, that I was not going to waste this organ. I was not going to drink. I was going to do everything I could to live this life and make the most out of receiving this gift if given the chance.
This is an impossible choice for hospitals. I mean, it really
Everybody's deserving.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to get at. Like every single human. And because people do make mistakes. Addiction is a disease. And we're not going to get into that today, but we will at some point. And the thing is that no one person is technically more deserving than another person. But they have to make it fair. So there's a numbers game here. And they are using a rubric or a checklist to make determinations. One thing I really like about each committee that is at each hospital, they have not just doctors and nurses, they also have community members that are weighing in. And I love that because they're doing their best to look at each human as a whole. And this is an impossible decision. So even though we're talking very technically about this, I want to just not forget how difficult this is, not just for the families, but for the teams of the liver, in this case, the liver transplant teams that are making these decisions. And they have to make the cases too. They bring the cases up to the committee.
Before we did this podcast, I had some questions from my sister, but it was very interesting, your answers. I was asking when they're determining eligibility and requirements, if certain things played a part, like age, race, gender, and how they came about these decisions. And by you telling me that there were like community members and not just medical professionals making these decisions, that was very interesting to me because it just sounds like it's a fair system.
I think they're doing their absolute best to make it as fair as possible. And this is the way I explain it to my parents too. So you can think of this in like three buckets. So there's this bucket, we'll call it physiology. That's your physical body. That's all the diagnostics, which Stacey will go into next about things that they're looking at. Can your body handle this? You could have a MELD score of 16, but have a taxed cardiac system. That doesn't make you a good candidate then versus somebody who's at 35 who does not have a taxed heart. So there's a lot of things that they're getting into. So that's physiology. And then there's the sociology bucket, right? Which is some of that demographic stuff. But it's also things like your support system. Where are you going to go after you get this surgery? Are you going home to people who are going to care for you? Or are you going to be going to a long-term care facility?
Are you able to demonstrate that you have people visiting you at the hospital? You have a support system. You know, hey, I saw Stacy here with her mom all the time. You know, her mom's really going to help her if she has some trouble not drinking. Her mom's going to be there for her. I can tell.
And even if you don't have family members, are you eligible for in-home care? It doesn't just have to be your family, but there needs to be support for you after the surgery. Also, that has a big impact on things like relapsing and other things. Like, when did you last complete rehab? And would you be willing to continue to talk to a psychologist?
That is if it's an addiction type issue like mine was.
That's right. And then the third bucket that we can think about are things that are completely out of our control, which is how many other people there are on the list, what the average MELD score is at that hospital. These are things you really can't know, but they do have an impact on you and your ability to both get on the list and also receive a liver. So there's kind of like three buckets you can think about. And you want to focus on the things you can control. You don't want to focus on the things you can't.
So we have chosen our hospital.
We have.
Or hospitals in my case. I was looking at two. I have met their team of doctors. I am hopeful, you know, trying to remain hopeful. And now is the time that they are going to check me out. In the simplest of terms, this is like a very detailed physical.
It's like a whole body intensive check.
They are going to send you, like a car sends through diagnostics to figure out what problems they are. They're going to do that for your body. Now, each hospital can be different. I know that I had certain things waived, like my dental. I don't have any previous history of cavities, but something as small as a bunch of cavities or missing teeth where it can be infected and that's a nerve and then can get right to your heart. Those are the things that can affect you. So that was waived, but I have a history of heart problems on my mother's side. So I had to do some very extensive simulated heart attack stuff that was crazy, just not fun and painful.
So normally you would go through a cardiac stress test, right? But if somebody is as sick as Stacy was, they can't go through the typical cardiac stress test where you're out there on the treadmill trying to get your heart rate up to a certain point. Yeah. So instead they do something else called LexiScan. They give you an injection that simulates as if you were on the treadmill. I've had it done myself as well. It is terrible, but you go through it and kind of, I felt like I was running a marathon in like 30 seconds flat. And then they bring you back down out of that, but they have to tax your heart to measure how it handles stress. And that's what they're doing.
And this is all a determination to figure out if you survived the surgery.
Mm-hmm. Well, as best they can.
Right.
Because things happen, but they want to try to get as much data as possible. Data doesn't have feelings associated with it. They're just numbers.
They're going to test your blood. They're going to test your breathing. They're going to test your joints, your bones, pretty much anything you can think of. They're going to run you through the ringer. They want to know the good, the bad, the ugly. They want to know it all. And this is helping them inform their decision to get on the UNOS list. Now, we did skip over something that I think is a bit important. A lot of the times I was super grateful to have not just specifically my sister, but a person with me, because the sicker I got, the foggier I got. I'm going to mispronounce the words. So since this is the acronym game we're playing today, I'm going to say HE, but what I'm really saying is
hepatic encephalopathy. And this is a great time actually to bring this up. So two things I wanted to point out. When a person is in liver failure, they're going to have bouts of something called hepatic encephalopathy, we'll call HE. And Stacy will describe it better than I will because she's the one who's experienced it, but it's a fogginess, it's a disorientation. Basically, it is toxins that are building up in your system that are swimming through and making it difficult for your brain to function. And that means that you may not always know where you are, you may not know who you're talking to, and it's a scale. It starts usually kind of small and then it progresses until they can get that worked out. And of course, if you're in liver failure, it only goes in one direction. And once it starts, usually it's an admission and you have to go through and they have to flush out your system and get rid of some of those toxins. But with that said, that means that I'm talking about these really complicated things with my sister, and we've gone deep into talking about the calculations and the numbers. And I don't think any doctor and any team expects you to understand even what we've already described here. But understanding and knowing the background is for us to say to you, we want you to know it's as fair as it can be. But you have to walk through all these hoops. So now you have a person who might be having this episode of HE. On top of that is being forced to go through CTs with contrast and so they call them CTPAs, which are basically CAT scans of the pelvic area and all the way in your torso with dye. You can't eat, which makes all of those things worse. It exacerbates these symptoms. And you have a very short timeline. It's like a gauntlet. It's like the amazing race, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You have to go through all this stuff and takes a long time and you don't have a long time. So that's a decision that you have to make with your healthcare advocate to decide how many of these tests can I get done, how quickly? And then you're dealing with scheduling at the hospital and trying to get in. I took a lot of who canceled today appointments. Can we just come on down?
For the HE, I will say it's like a deep fogginess. A lot of it's similar to a blackout where I know I'm somewhere. And then hours later, I'm somewhere else, whether it be in location or mind, and I have a loss of time. As I've gotten healthier, some of these memories have come back to me. It's stuff that's been going on, and some of them have just been told to me. But for those around me, it's almost like a blank stare, like a light has switched off. I have been told that I just didn't look like me. I didn't look like I was behind my eyes. There was no what's normally behind my eyes.
She got very childlike, in my opinion. And at the hospital, they're going to ask you cognitive questions. What year is it? Who's the president? That's what they're asking you, is to see how cognitively deficient you are, which is another point we should add in here, why it's so important that you have a power of attorney and a health directive at a hospital. Because when a person has hepatic encephalopathy, they are not able to make their own decisions because maybe you're on the low level scale of that, but it's going to progress and she's not able to process information properly. So you are, as the health advocate, making the decisions.
I had an especially awful episode of this. An ambulance ended up having to be called. I have no memory. I had been not drinking. I wasn't even drinking at the time. I was watching a football game. And then hours later, I woke up in the hospital to a male nurse saying, "Do you know who's president? Do you know what year it is? Do you know what month it is?" And those questions were peppered over me for the next 6 hours as I laid there and slowly made my way out of it. And some of those answers I got right, some of them I got wrong. It was terrifying. It was one of the scariest things to ever happen to me to wake up there and have that loss of time. But this is not uncommon. And so it makes it even that much more important to have someone with you, especially when you're meeting these team of doctors and you're going through this preparation to get onto the list, going through these diagnostics, these evaluations, to figure out if there is a place for you on this list to receive the life-saving organ transplant.
And I don't want to make light of this because people who have lost their lives that are donating, I'm glad that there are this many criteria in place to try to make it as fair as possible. But also, I mean, this is a life-saving gift and there's no other way to talk about that. It should not be easy to go through this process, especially depending how you got here, because there's a lot of trust involved, right? They have to trust it. In the case of addiction, you're not going to drink again.
Yeah, I'm not going to waste this chance at life I've been given because my life was almost just extinguished by something I did.
Not only do you have hepatic encephalopathy going on off and on with end-stage liver failure, but also most people, when they have a MELD score of a certain amount and higher, they're either in palliative or hospice or they're floating back and forth. And basically, you are chronically and terminally ill, which makes you eligible for certain care. And as your MELD score gets higher and as you get more sick, you're going to need more care. And it goes from treatment in palliative care to what they call comfort care in hospice. And the only reason why I mention this is because while you're in these places, you're trying to run all these diagnostics, which requires you to go to the hospital. If you're not admitted, if you're home like we were at that time, we're running around doing all these things, which requires stamina and energy, and it requires a sort of mental capacity of strength, which my sister, I've never seen a person that has her level of mental strength. And I hope that we're going to talk about that a little bit in today's podcast, because I think it had a huge impact on her success to fight and to get to that point where she had the opportunity to survive.
So let's get excited. You are on the list. You have been accepted at your chosen hospital, and you are on the list with a score.
This is my day of celebration, by the way. This was the one thing that I remember more than anything. I think this was the one time that I broke down completely without any control.
You did. We took, I had my laptop on. We were in the hospital. Yeah. I had my laptop on the bed right in front of us, and I snapped a picture real quick while Julie was behind me. The joy on her faces.
So my sister was admitted. She was admitted for pneumonia. And I was really concerned because, of course, that would be a factor, right? And her MELD score was 38 and climbing. And it was so funny because the way that she thinks about it, the way that I think about it, for me, this was the linchpin. This was the keystone, right? Because if we didn't get on the list, there was absolutely no chance whatsoever that she was ever going to be saved. For her, it was like, well, yeah, I needed to get on the list. And then for her, it was getting the organ. But for me, that was it. Like, that was a turning point for me. That was all this work and everything that we had endured together. It was going to happen now.
Everybody's story is different. It varies. I have talked to a bunch of different people. I have talked to people who have only been on the list 17 days and got their organ. I talked to another lady who had been on the list 1,030 days and was still waiting. Some people 8, 9 months. For me, it was 4 days. I think 3, 4 days.
It was 4 days. After she got on the UNOS list, before an organ was available and that she was eligible for, that it was a match.
So everyone's story is going to be different. And the wait list is called the wait list for a reason.
Also, she was number one on the UNOS list for the University of Cincinnati, But she was number one because she was the highest MELD score of anyone in the program. So there's some bittersweetness here because being higher on the list means that you might get an organ a little bit faster, but it also means that you might die before you get the chance.
Each of our stories is unique and different, but I'm going to be a little general for a second. Know that you must have your phone on you at all times. I got lucky. I was in the hospital when a liver arrived that matched me. But most people are going to rely on a phone call. Now, answer your phone. Always, 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 always answer your phone. The phone number could come from any number. It may not say hospital. It may say unknown. The number could be anything. But you will always be ready and available. You are just waiting for this phone call so that you can get there. And know this as well, that you may hold your phone in your hand for days and days on end. And the moment you set that phone down is when it's going to ring. It will happen when you least expect it to. You've got all this excitement and this buildup, and you want it to happen right now, right? Because you made the list. That's not always the case. Like that woman who is still waiting over 1,000 days. She's just waiting. But be ready. Also know that there can be what I call test runs or false alarms. There's a lot of things that go into actually preparing that organ and making sure that it fits you and making sure that everything comes together.
So the organ is tested when it is donated or harvested, which I know is a terrible word, but at the place where they collect it. Then it has to travel to where you are and they retest it there. Meanwhile, you have to make it to the hospital in a time frame that allows all of that to work, and they have to prep you. All your labs have to be okay in that exact moment. Then the organ has to be ready and still functioning and made the journey and still be intact and viable. Then at that point, there's last minute diagnostics to make the final decision, and then you could go down. The other thing that can happen is, so when you're chronically ill or terminally ill on the UNOS list, you're a 1B. But if somebody were like in a car accident and was in liver failure and they come into the ER,
life-threatening,
they're a 1A and they will bump you. A 1A will bump a 1B. It's called acute because it's right now. It's a life-saving right now measure. So even if everything was all aligned and you were ready to go, if somebody came into the ER of that hospital, they could bump you on the list. So even you could be there in a hospital gown, ready to be wheeled down and still not get your liver.
Being on this list, waiting is a very difficult thing to do. So positivity will go a long way here. The worst thing a liver recipient, organ recipient, the worst word they can ever think of is the word rejection. It's every organ transplant nightmare. And as you'll hear my sister say, there's a lot of different events, small rejection events, large rejection events that you go through after receiving an organ. But the reason why there are all these stipulations and all this extra testing and everything that goes along with this is because they want to make sure that you're going to get the most compatible organ for your body to not go into some sort of rejection. This is a very complicated, involved surgery. Most of these organs aren't easy to get to. The liver especially, the kidneys, none of those things are very easy to get to. The surgeries can be long. In my case, it was very messy, which I don't like that, but it's actually written in my chart that my surgery was messy. They do everything they can possible to make sure that you don't end up in any sort of rejection stage. So as disheartening as it can be for these false alarms, these no-goes, these test runs, they're for the best. And you have to trust the system and trust the process that's in place, that it's going to work out and it's what's gonna be best for you.
So we have a saying, comparison is the thief of joy. And I think about this a lot because in these situations, you can't really compare yourself to anybody else, even if you've met them or seen them in the hallway or on your floor or whatever, because this is where the trust thing comes in. The things you can't control, the things you don't know. You have to trust your medical team knows what's best, and they have to trust that they're going to do what's best for you and for really society at large. It's called, in science, we call it benefice. It's the benefit to society. So we have a limited number of resource organs, and we have a large number of people that need them. And the way to make this the most fair is to try to find the best match. And I think that Stacey's done a really good job of explaining that there's a lot involved. Knowing a little bit about it and why we wanted to do this podcast in this way today was so that you can hear some of the background in a simplified way. I mean, I'm not going into like the deep formulas or whatever. Your medical professionals, they are very skilled at understanding what diagnostics mean. I'm not a doctor. We're not out there running these things. I felt better knowing it was fair. Understanding a little bit about, there's been a lot of thought put into this process, makes it a little bit easier to accept some of the disappointments that are going to happen along the way. And they will absolutely happen along the way. I remember stressors, like just waiting for her to get through a diagnostic test, knowing what the minimum threshold for passing it was, and just hoping and hoping that she was going to meet that minimum. What if that day she was in worse space than she was the day before? Can't control those things, and they're constantly checking. So the diagnostics are important to keep you on the list. And like we mentioned before, she had to go for blood work quite often. Even when she was in hospice, they would come and take the blood work, but we had to, because we had to make sure she was constantly still eligible. You can become more and less eligible. Stacey was actually what they call standard exception. Because remember, I mentioned earlier, we've talked about her being rejected a couple of times. Well, at some point, her MELD score got high enough. The other thing about Stacey, too, is that her kidneys bounce back. And because we have to look at both the kidneys and the liver, if her kidneys had not maintained, and it was amazing that they did, her kidneys always bounced back. And oftentimes, people get both a liver and a kidney.
I was not going to be able to survive that likely surgery. Not. It was going to be too complicated.
Yeah.
So that wasn't going to be an option for me. I think only liver transplant was on the table.
Yeah.
But to point to this, and I do want to say this because it's important to me, and I'm not sure how this is going to come across, if it's new agey or what my mom says, hippy dippy. I don't know. But I think positive mindset will go a long way as a patient during this specific part of the process. Now, I'm not talking about the pain. I'm talking specifically about the wait list and the time. Building up to it, getting on it, and then waiting till you get that life-saving phone call where you've been chosen. You got it. I have worked really hard to put myself in a specific positive and determined mindset to make sure that I can get through these procedures, get through these things, look past what I'm doing in that moment to the future. Life is amazing, and I am so grateful to be where I am at this moment in time that I would have done anything to live. I'm so regretful of some of the choices I made that led me to this point where I needed this, but there was no way I was going to squander this opportunity or not do everything I could within my control, including willing my kidneys to get in shape so that this opportunity wasn't squandered, that I wasn't passed over. You know, I was determined to show that my body was strong enough, and my mind played a large part in that.
It did. So I would encourage everybody to go to our website and join our community, because there will be a bunch of resources there. We'll have this information about the UNOS list and the MELD score and all that. But we also will have information in TED Talks where they talk about mindset, drive, and grit and positive psychology.
Positive psychology.
Because I can tell you that you have to feel your feelings when they're happening, and you can be disappointed and you can be upset. We talked earlier about Kubler-Ross in a different podcast. I'll bring it back. You're constantly going through stages of that, but you can't stay there. Getting acceptance and moving past it is really important. So be in your moment, have your feelings, but then you have to move past that. And the Herculean effort that I watched my sister do, absolutely 100% without any question of my mind, had an impact on her success in fighting, because she was able to accept the current situation and move past it. It's so hard to do, but it's so true that when you're sick, you don't feel well, you're grumpy, there's all these things that are going on. If you focus on just that and not think about the future, then I think what you're doing is a disservice to your mind and your brain and your body. It's amazing what positive psychology can do. And I know it's like woohoo, right? You know, hippy dippy, like you said, mom says. But the truth is that there's tons of scientific evidence out there that support this idea. So we're going to post a lot of these resources up for you, encourage you to take a look at them. It's important that your whole team of support, your health advocates, the people around you, recognize and encourage you to stay as positive as you possibly can, to have the grace and the trust and to think about it. I think sometimes we, I know I did, fought against that because I wanted to be reality-based. I wanted to be prepared for when she didn't make it, but there was no preparing for that. And so when you measure it, thinking about it, why not be positive? Because I can't change it. I don't have control over that, but I do have control over my own feelings.
I knew the reality of my situation. You've heard me say it a couple times during this podcast alone, that the outlook was bleak. It was dire. But that wasn't the only possibility. Yes, that was maybe the most realistic possibility of the path I was going to take, but it wasn't the only. So although I accepted that this was my reality and these were the path that I was on, it wasn't the only path I was able to take. So accepting where I was and what I was going through actually helped me to refocus and be more positive that, well, maybe this isn't the end. Maybe this isn't where it ends for me. And I think just that mindset, I will speak to it forever. It helped me get through procedures. It helped me refocus. You know, there's always a different outcome that can come of it. And remaining open to that, just open.
You just took the words right out of my mouth. I think you have to leave space for something good to happen, even if you're in the midst of everything that doesn't feel good. We did well at supporting each other in this. That's not to say that we were 100% all the time in this place.
Oh, no, we were far from perfect.
Absolutely. And you won't be either. And I think you have to have patience for yourself and those around you. And you can always reset. I mean, I used to walk out of the room and reset, even if it was for 30 seconds.
You did. It wasn't as easy for me because I was stuck in that bed that when you came back in, sometimes I was still in the same place.
I know, but I wasn't, and that changed the dynamic.
Right. Well, another thing I do want to touch on before we leave this is patient-focused. So as a patient, gotten the excitement of getting on the wait list or waiting for that call, you're fairly sick and your symptoms just tend to get more exacerbated, more focused.
Well, you're chronically ill and you're terminal, so you're going to get worse.
It's something about knowing that you're so close. Yeah. You're on that last step. You're so close. For me, it was a lot of itching. A lot of organ transplants will attest to this. The itching gets out of control. You just want to get out of your skin. My legs, my torso, my arms, very itchy. Quick tip, take hot showers, hot as possible. At one point, you know, I've taken 5 showers in a day to try to get rid of that itchiness. And it does work for a little bit.
Don't do it by yourself. Make sure there's somebody helping you in and out.
There's that caregiver. Also, ice chips. Italian ice, making sure my mouth was really cold. It helped me less focus on the other stuff that was bothering me. I went through Italian ices. I went through ice chips, smoothies, anything cold like that, slushies. I loved it.
And as another caregiver tip too, as a person gets more and more sick, their appetite is significantly reduced. So getting calories in is kind of hard. I'm going to put like these cool things that I found for her when we were going through this process. We'll link that up there on the community too. So you can look at that, what we used. I mean, there were certain things that you have to avoid from a nutritional standpoint, but the protein is so important in getting these nutritional things in. And it does really matter. Every day matters because we're waiting and we're trying to stay healthy enough to get the organ. So you start doing these things that increase your chances and try to prolong her life as much as possible. And I know we've said it, but Stacy was in hospice. She was sent home with weeks to live. And in hospice, they don't allow for quote unquote treatment, but food is medicine. So there's a lot of things you can still do that can be considered comfort care. For us, it was about keeping her levels as steady as possible so that there wasn't extreme changes, so she would still remain eligible. There's things you can do.
Also, to that note, I do want to shout out October 19th, 2020, I was given 2 weeks to live. And today, on March 25th, 2025, I celebrate my 46th birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you.
I've been wanting to sing happy birthday this whole time.
Oh, have you? That's funny. I was like, should I even mention it?
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, you know, my motto, look at how far I've come. Well, this kind of really reiterates at home, you know?
I do sometimes think of how many months, years, and days that I've continued to have her past the time when I thought I wouldn't. And I'm so incredibly grateful for everyone.
In these extra 4 years of my life, I have gotten married. I have traveled. I never thought I'd make it out west or to the desert, overseas again, out of the country. I skydived. I have done my best once I started to heal, to live as many moments, create as many memories as I can. Because average organ transplant, liver specifically, can be a lot more, can also be a lot less, is about 7 to 9 extra years of life.
And that depends on a lot of things, like how sick you were and whatever else. And keep that positive psychology going, right? Because, you know, we people defy probabilities and those are just numbers. Somebody does win the lottery, right?
I was given 2 weeks.
Yeah.
In October 19th of 2020.
Yep.
I didn't get my transplant till January of 2021. So I beat the odds there. And now I'm halfway through this average and I'm ready for another 20 years.
Yeah. Well, I'm ready for more than that.
I'm ready for it all.
She has to outlive me. The other thing I want to mention here is that even though these topics are really hard to talk about, I was thinking about her birthday, you know, today, actually. And I'm so glad that we're taking time to do this, to talk to all of you, to share with you our story. And we're sisters, so we bicker, we talk over each other. But again, I cannot express how much I would have been listening to us during this process. And that's why we're doing it. And thank you all for joining us in this journey as we talk about our story. But also go to our website, join our community, talk to us about what's going on with you and to each other. We'll share with you as much as we possibly can as we go through. Again, we don't know everything. We just know our story. But maybe that helps some of you. So we hope you're surviving and thriving.
I know I'm surviving and thriving.
Exactly. And happy birthday to my sister.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, everybody. That's a wrap for this episode of Life Expectancy, Sisters Surviving and Thriving. If you'd like to stay close to the journey or eventually connect with others navigating similar paths, join us at life-expectancy.com. Membership is free, and we'll be opening up new ways to share, learn, and thrive together soon. Special thanks to Ryan Brunn, whose original music scores our episode with depth, and to our producer, Kenzie, who brings it all to life. And if you're a music person like us, search Life Expectancy Podcast Season 1 on Spotify, or visit the site to find our companion playlist and all of our socials. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.